Magpie Murders, written by Anthony Horowitz, read by Samantha Bond and Alan Corduna. There was going to be a funeral. The two gravediggers, old Jeff Weaver and his son Adam, had been out at first light and everything was ready. A grave dug to the exact proportions, the earth neatly piled to one side. The church of St. Botolph's in Saxby-on-Avon had never looked lovelier, the morning sun glinting off the stained glass windows. The church dated back to the 12th century, although, of course, it had been rebuilt many times. The new grave was to the east, close to the ruins of the old chancel where the grass was allowed to grow wild and daisies and dandelions sprouted around the broken arches. The village itself was quiet, the streets empty. The milkman had already made his deliveries and disappeared, the bottles rattling on the back of his van. The newspaper boys had done their rounds. This was a Saturday, so nobody would be going to work, and it was still too early for the homeowners to begin their weekend chores. At 9 o'clock, the village shop would open. The smell of bread, fresh out of the oven, was already seeping out of the baker's shop next door. Their first customers would be arriving soon. Once breakfast was over, a chorus of lawnmowers would start up. It was July, the busiest time of the year for Saxby-on-Avon's keen army of gardeners, and with the harvest fair just a month away, roses were already being pruned, marrows carefully measured. At 1:30, there was to be a cricket match on the village green. There would be an ice cream van, children playing, visitors having picnics in front of their cars. The tea shop would be open for business. A perfect English summer's afternoon. But not yet. It was as if the village was holding its breath in respectful silence, waiting for the coffin that was about to begin its journey from Bath. Even now, it was being loaded into the hearse, surrounded by its somber attendants, 5 men and a woman, all of them avoiding each other's eye, as if they were unsure where to look. 4 of the men were professional undertakers from the highly respected firm of Lanner and Crane. The company had existed since Victorian times, when it had been principally involved in carpentry and construction. At that time, coffins and funerals had been a sideline, almost an afterthought. But, perversely, it was this part of the business that had survived. Lanner and Crane no longer built homes, but their name had become a byword for respectful death. Today's event was very much the economy package. The hearse was an older model. There were to be no black horses or extravagant wreaths. The coffin itself, though handsomely finished, had been manufactured from what was, without question, inferior wood. A simple plaque, silver-plated rather than silver, carried the name of the deceased and the 2 essential dates. Mary Elizabeth Blakiston, the 5th of April 1887 to the 15th of July 1955. Her life had not been as long as it seemed, crossing 2 centuries as it did, but then it had been cut short quite unexpectedly. There had not even been enough money in Mary's funeral plan to cover the final costs. Not that it mattered, as the insurers would cover the difference, and she would have been glad to see that everything was proceeding according to her wishes. The hearse left exactly on time, setting out on the 8-mile journey as the minute hand reached 9:30. Continuing at an appropriately sedate pace, it would arrive at the church on the hour. If Lanner and Crane had had a slogan, it might well have been, "Never late." And although the 2 mourners travelling with the coffin might not have noticed it, the countryside had never looked lovelier, the fields on the other side of the low, flint walls sloping down towards the River Avon, which would follow them all the way. In the cemetery at St. Botolph's, the 2 gravediggers examined their handiwork. There are many things to be said about a funeral, profound, reflective, philosophical, but Jeff Weaver got it right, as leaning on his spade and rolling a cigarette in between his grubby fingers, he turned to his son. "If you're going to die," he said, "you couldn't choose a better day."